Please silence all electronic devices.
It's a really bad situation. On the other hand, we'd be inflicting even more trauma on our kids if we somehow tried to return them to school in the immediate term. So this is obviously the right decision, but it's a painful one.
I don't envy the governor. You know, when he ran to be the governor of North Carolina, nobody could even have imagined that these would be the kind of challenges that he's facing.
Any further discussion or debate?
From Northern Wake County, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Glad to have you along for another Friday News Roundup with Becky Gray of the conservative John Locke Foundation and Rob Schofield of the progressive NC Policy Watch. We're chatting about the extension of the stay-at-home order, what local and state governments need to do to support schools, which are not coming back this academic year. And I also asked Becky and Rob about whether there are any industries we're not paying enough attention to. Here are your panelists.
Hi, guys.
Hey there.
We are recording this early Friday afternoon, and we learned today that kindergarten through 12th grade public schools across the state will not return this academic year. An unsurprising development in this big moment, but still a consequential note as part of this pandemic. It's possible school calendars will change and that classrooms are again filled in August, but the future remains quite murky. In the short term, what is something that local and state governments need to do to support students and educators? Becky?
Well, I think the first thing is this online learning. And I just know anecdotally from members of my family that students have really looked forward and have gotten real value out of touching base with their teachers and their classmates. So I think to continue this online learning and kind of the switch that we all had pushed upon us, I think for the most part, in an emergency and when we've needed to, this has worked quite well. I would like to offer support to the teachers and the students to continue this because I think it's important for the students to stay connected, to have that little bit of discipline. And then also, I think the assignments and the learning that's taking place has been most valuable. So if I had to recommend one thing, and I know that the General Assembly, when they come back next week, I think are going to be looking at these kind of things of, you know, how do we make this bridge in learning in kind of this new normal of online learning? So I just would like to continue what we've done.
Well, I don't disagree that obviously online learning is critically important, and it's going to need a lot of bolstering to really do its job at even a close approximation to what real education, real classroom learning is like. I mean, we know for a fact that a lot of kids don't even have internet access. A lot of kids don't have computers in lots of parts of our state. A lot of kids are living in situations that, you know, are really, really suboptimal in terms of them having a healthy home life that would even, we know this is an incredibly difficult situation for the best oriented, best situated families with all the resources they need and lots of adults around who can help their kids. So we know that this is only a stopgap solution and it's not even working very well. There are tons of kids being left behind. So we've got a lot of work to do just to make this very stopgap interim system work better. And then there's just all kinds of other things we need to think about in terms of the trauma that we're inflicting on our children and on our teachers and our education system. There's going to be a significant need in the months ahead for therapy and counseling and advice for people on how to grapple with this unprecedented situation. So it's a really bad situation. On the other hand, we'd be inflicting even more trauma on our kids if we somehow tried to return them to school in the immediate term. So this is obviously the right decision, but it's a painful one.
Well, and I think in this too, you know, the dependency and the new learning that we've all taken with how to communicate and how to do things through technology and online offers real opportunities of expanding this. You know, this has worked well for a lot of families. This has worked well for a lot of kids, you know, in difficult situations. And so that's something else we're learning is that, you know, perhaps the traditional classroom with 20 students and a teacher at the front of the classroom, you know, may not be the best learning opportunity for every single kid. So, you know, that's the other thing. I think it's given us an opportunity to look at this. I think one thing that we're going to really know at when we come to the other side of this is the importance of technology and the opportunities that are available through technology. And I think absolutely this is going to translate into different and better, newer ways to teach and learn. And I think we're going to see that through K through 12 at the community colleges as well as the university. So I think, you know, we can look at this as an opportunity to move forward.
We cannot allow this to be used as an excuse to undermine traditional public schools. And there have been just loads of very powerful essays written by school teachers who have explained the tremendous loss that they and their students are suffering as a result of not being able to have the physical contact, the kind of intimate contact that a teacher has with children in a regular classroom. We cannot make that the end result of this, that we move in the direction of de-emphasizing the idea of traditional public school classrooms. We need them more than ever. Sure, we need online learning. Not everybody learns exactly the same in a traditional classroom, but it would be a grave tragedy if we moved away from traditional public schools.
Well, that's the point. I mean, you know, kids learn in different ways. Teachers teach in different ways. And what we ought to be looking for is the best way to employ those. This is not a one-size-fits-all answer. This is how many answers can we come up with to make sure that every child is receiving the best education in the best way that fits them and their families' needs. And I think that this is an opportunity to explore that and look at that. So, you know, again, kind of these silver linings that we're looking at, this is a difficult time. There is no question about it. But, you know, I think there's also an opportunity to look for ways that we can do things better. And I think this is one in education that, you know, we can look at ways to do this better.
The stay-at-home order will continue until at least May 8th. Governor Roy Cooper announced a three-phase plan on Thursday. Most likely for many, this stay-at-home order will actually extend through much of May across the state. And Cooper was diverging from governors in South Carolina, Tennessee, and Georgia in going with a more deliberate approach to begin to try to return to normal. There will be benchmarks, among them reduction in hospitalizations, that would have to be met in order for these phases to move forward. There have been some critics, of course, some saying that this will doom the restaurant industry. Using science and the data that is available to him, could Cooper have handled this any differently, Rob?
I don't think so. I think he was just heroic. I think that Secretary Cohen was just incredibly coherent and logical in her presentation, as was the governor. And it stands in such stark contrast to the clown show at the White House, where we've got the president of the United States suggesting that people should be drinking bleach or having it injected into their bodies. It's just astounding. He stands out so markedly in comparison, and I think he provides just the right combination of hope and realism, and he's guided by science and facts and common sense. I don't think there's much more he could have done. And indeed, when you look at the actual recommendations from the White House and not the nonsense that comes out of the president's mouth, he's basically following the Trump recommendations. So it's a very conservative plan. He's obviously anxious to get us back to, you know, back to some semblance of real life, but he's doing it in the most logical and common sense way it could be done.
Well, I don't envy the governor. You know, when he ran to be the governor of North Carolina, nobody could even have imagined that these would be the kind of challenges that he's facing. So I don't envy his position, try to lead us through this. You know, everybody has said we need to do this safely. So it all comes down to we've got to have more data. We've got to have more testing. We've got to know how many people in the population may be immune to it. I mean, there's just all kinds of information that we're not being able to get, whether it is information by zip code, whether it is you know, we don't know which of the nursing homes in North Carolina are having these hotspot breakouts. You know, there's still a lot of information that is not being disclosed or is not available, and it all hinges on the data and the testing. And so there's still just a lot of uncertainty, and I think it just feeds the anxiety and the hopelessness for a lot of people who are out of work with no income through no fault of their own.
State lawmakers gavel in Tuesday. It's likely to be a 2 or 3 day session. Among the items on the expected docket, appropriating funds for the healthcare sector, changes aimed at allowing government agencies to continue operating as smoothly as possible. What proposals have jumped out to you?
I'm struck by, we talked about this last week, that we're still talking about the idea of getting Medicaid to pay for people who are testing positive for the virus, which is a tremendous idea. And it's points out the absurdity of the current situation and what will be the situation when we make that change, that someone who goes into the hospital with pneumonia, if it's because they have COVID-19, Medicaid will pay for it and North Carolina will help. But if they don't, if it's caused by something else, then they won't get help, which is just absurd situation. It's great that we're going to provide some coverage to people. But again, I think I hear it time and again all day long from progressive advocates, advocates really across the political spectrum in our state, hospitals, businesses, that this is crazy that we're not expanding Medicaid to bring in billions of federal dollars to help our healthcare system at a moment of such dire crisis, when our health, even our healthiest hospitals are struggling mightily because of the cancellation of elective surgery and other higher profit services.
Well, expanding Medicaid is a huge expansion of a government program that, I mean, right now in the middle of a global pandemic with hospitals stretched as much as they can possibly been, you know, the Medicaid expansion that the governor had proposed was a $6 billion program in the first 2 years. I mean, you know, look at the revenue that's going to be coming in. I mean, and there's money coming from the federal government. I am certain that there will be money allocated through the General Assembly next week to help these patients and help these sick people make sure that their medical bills are covered. You know, this is not the time to start talking about expanding a very fragile program to begin with. I mean, this is a discussion that needs to happen later, not right now in the middle of this.
I can guarantee you the Republican governor of Ohio is very happy he's got it right now. He's very happy that lots of people are being covered and that his hospitals are in a lot better situation than they are in North Carolina.
Well, part of the problem with the hospitals in North Carolina is they have not been able to do the elective surgery and other things that have been helpful in keeping their revenue up. Now, I understand some of the hospitals are doing this, you know, which kind of begs the question, if hospitals are expanding what they're doing, isn't it time to allow other businesses to expand what they're doing as well? Safely, of course. But lots of questions here. And, you know, Jeff, in answer to your question about, you know, what are we looking for next week? What are some of the things that we're looking at? These the House Select COVID committees have been looking at a lot of the deadlines and extending those, putting waivers in place for things like the certificate of need laws. You know, certificate of need laws in North Carolina prohibited the expansion of hospital beds. So one of the first things they did was they waived that certificate of need law. And I expect the General Assembly is going to be looking at some of those other waivers of restrictions and regulations that have been put into place, not only in healthcare, but across state government that we've seen through this are really unnecessary or unneeded. Some of the things like allowing teachers who had retired but want to come back into the profession, healthcare workers who had retired or are here with licenses from other states that are able to step in during this emergency kind of time that we have. The expansion of telemedicine, you know, is another area. Again, talking about innovation and things that we've learned through this crisis, the reliance and the ability to increase access to healthcare through telemedicine through this, I think is something that's here to stay, and I think we'll see movements with that in the General Assembly just next week to ensure that those options are available too, again, to make sure that people have access to quality health care at a low cost. And then, you know, some things in education too, looking at, you know, how are we going to get through this? One of the things that I hope we revisit and talk about again is a lot of the testing, the year-end testing that has been going on with K through 12 students. You know, we've waived a lot of that. I think it's time to look at that and say, okay, as we put that back into place, what do we really need and how can we do this better? How can we do a lot of things better as we get through this and begin to put things back in place, things that we've been able to waive or delay through this emergency and for emergency reasons. I think it's really time to look at a lot of those things and make some choices about, you know, gee, do we need to do this at all, you know, as we get back to whatever the new normal is.
Again, I would just reiterate that this is not the time for simply tinkering around the edges, which is what I think we've just heard a description of. This is a time for attacking one of the greatest crises in the history of our country, certainly in the modern era, and attacking it, addressing human suffering on a significant level, not simply, you know, sure, great, change some deadlines, deal with school testing, those kinds of tinkering around the edges things. Those things ought to be no-brainers that could be done in a day. But the kind of genuine attack on human suffering that is going to, that is occurring now. We've already heard descriptions of it from Becky about businesses that are going out of business, restaurant industry, hospitality industry. There's a long list of industries and individuals who are suffering more than any time in 80 years. That requires government to attack the problem, not just to tinker around the edges.
But it means to attack it in a responsible, correct way. I mean, we have $2 trillion that is being dispersed by the federal government around the country, the largest expansion of government one time that I think we've ever seen in history. The General Assembly is considering billions of dollars of aid distributed through state government next week when they come back. So, you know, the help is there, certainly. And, you know, but there's a lot of things that we can do. I think it's to attack the problems, but it's to do it right. And some of these decisions will need to be made next week, and some of them will be needed to be made later. But I think that we need to do this smart.
One more for you. I want to talk about what we're not talking about. Since mid-March, there have now been more than 700,000 North Carolinians who have applied for unemployment benefits. Workers in the restaurant and service industry, as well as gig workers, even freelancers, have received, appropriately, a decent amount of attention. I'm wondering what industries are not getting enough attention or support.
Well, I don't know if they're not getting enough attention or support from, I mean, for instance, the governor announced this week, or his administration announced a very important expansion of unemployment insurance to cover contractors and people who are, you know, not in traditional workforce jobs, and that's great. But there, I think it's important for us to keep in mind, we sort of have envisioned that it's only people in, you know, sort of the gig economy or people who are working in hospitality. Obviously, this is affecting everyone. This is affecting tech workers. This is affecting healthcare workers who are being laid off. It's affecting public employees who are losing their jobs as a result of government being stressed out. We don't have the kind of relief from Washington that was expected to come down to aid state and local government. We're going to need that. We've already heard about DOT employees being laid off. I think the bottom line message is this is hurting everybody. It's going across the economy, nonprofits, for-profits. We have in mind sort of the classic example. My own daughter is an employee of a restaurant that's, you know, out of business. And so I'm very intimately familiar with that kind of unemployment. But I think it's important for us to keep in mind that it's affecting everyone.
I absolutely agree. I think no one, no industry, nobody is untouched by this. But, Jeff, a couple of things particularly concern me, and one of them is the farmers and the food supply chains that we have. You know, we're seeing pictures of, you know, mounds of potatoes, of farmers plowing under crops that they were going to harvest, but there's nobody to buy them. Some of the meat processing plants around the country have been closed because of infection or suspected infection of the coronavirus. I'm concerned about the food supply chain, the farmers and the people that are feeding, the industries that are feeding us. I'm very concerned about the disruption in that. And the other thing that I'm really concerned about, as we watch this economy continue to go down, the devastation to the economy and the support that we've always seen for nonprofits. And, you know, in many communities, nonprofits feel a tremendous need, whether it's food banks or whether it's, you know, Interact and support for women and children. And, I mean, you know, the list goes on and on and on with the nonprofits. And as more people are out of work, as more companies go under and there's less and less money in people's pockets, I think that the nonprofits and the very, very important work that they provide is going to be hurt through this too. And again, I agree with Rob. I mean, I don't think anybody or any industry is going to be left untouched through this when it's all over.
Rob Schofield is director of NC Policy Watch. Becky Gray is senior vice president at the John Locke Foundation. Enjoy your weekends.
Have a good weekend.
Hang in there, guys.
You can subscribe to the WUNC Politics podcast wherever it is that you do on-demand listening. Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, of course, a popular option as well. And while you're over there, if you are not yet tuning into WUNC's short-run daily podcast called Tested, it's all about how the state is responding to this pandemic, I would recommend you go ahead and subscribe to that program as well. I was on the program earlier this week chatting about unemployment. For Becky and Rob, I'm Jeff. We'll talk to you again soon. Enjoy your weekend.